Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now, Judith Sloan and Najla Said, who are holding three events in Manhattan and Brooklyn this month, trying to talk about Israel and Gaza, Jewish identity and Palestinian identity, and engage in dialogue rather than diatribe in a different kind of way. Judith is an actor, writer, educator, and radio producer, and Najla is an actor, writer, and activist. Their project is called Imperfect Allies, Children of Opposite Sides. It combines a 15-minute theater piece with a dialogue that follows among the audience members who sign up because they want to engage with people not like them from diverse backgrounds. Imperfect Allies, if you will, Children from Opposite Sides, as the title goes. They have three such events coming up in the next week that we'll tell you about. Disclosure, Judith Sloan happens to be my sister-in-law, married to my brother. Najla Said has a much more famous and important relative than me. She's the daughter of Edward Said, the late Columbia University professor who wrote the seminal book on Western attitudes toward Eastern and Middle Eastern peoples called Orientalism. Before they join us live, we'll hear two excerpts from performances by each of them. First, here is a two-minute excerpt in which Najla reads from her book, Looking for Palestine. It's her autobiography, talking about herself and her father.
My father was a teacher of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. I learned to pronounce that impressive-sounding title at the age of four, though I had no idea what it meant. When people asked me what my daddy's job was, I'd wrap my brain in articulators around the phrase with great effort and draw it out. I did recognize the word Columbia, and I knew what that was. The park where we played after school and on weekends. I also knew that he did something in an office in that campus park. To very smart people who study a lot, Edward Said is the father of post-colonial studies. Or, as he told me once, when he insisted I was wasting my college education by taking a course on postmodernism, and I told him he didn't even know what it was. Know what it is, Najla. I invented it. I still don't know if he was joking or serious. To others, he's the author of Orientalism, the book that everyone reads at some point in college, whether in history, politics, Buddhism, or literature class. He wrote it when I was four. As he explained once when I pressed him to put it into simple English, the basic concept is that, historically, through literature and art, the East, as seen through a Western lens, becomes distorted and degraded, so that anything other than what we Westerners recognize as familiar is not just exotic, mysterious, and sensual, but also inherently inferior. You know, like Aladdin. It's mainly because of my father that people now say Asian American instead of Oriental.
Najla Said, a co-creator of the theater and dialogue project called Imperfect Allies, Children from Opposite Sides. That was an excerpt from her book, or reading of her book, Looking for Palestine. Now here's the other imperfect ally, Judith Sloan, whose previous theater works include Yo Miss and Denial of the Fittest, one-woman shows that played in New York, and she is co-author of the book Crossing the Boulevard, Strangers, Neighbors, Aliens in a New America. This excerpt is a minute and a half of a piece of hers called Dayenu. This is set at a Passover Seder, framed around a song that people sing at the Seder, for those of you unfamiliar, called Dayenu, which thanks God for freeing the Jewish people from bondage in ancient Egypt. And you'll hear the word Haggadah. The Haggadah is the book that tells the Passover story.
Each year at Passover, I think about, argue about, dream about, and question this question of Dayenu. Enough. Dayenu. I take down the silver-plated Haggadah given to me by my father when I was a little girl. This Haggadah, one of the few things I have left of him. I inherited the questioning, the dark eyes, dark hair, dark moods. I look through this Haggadah, a marriage of text and image, the pages designed like the pages of the Talmud, taken from the Talmud, multiple arguments on two-page spreads in four colors. Is there enough to go around? Is my freedom dependent on your loss? The argument erupts every year at the Seder. An 80-year-old is criticizing the state of Israel. Israel should stop dehumanizing the Palestinians. A 60-year-old is defending Israel. What about Hamas? They'll stop at nothing. They call for the murder of Jews everywhere. The 20-year-old agrees with the 80-year-old. It's Israel's responsibility, too. The 40-year-old is trying to negotiate at the table. The 60-year-old cannot see the Palestinians as human. They are the enemy. But who is going to stop the path of mutual homicide? Suicide.
Judith Sloan there, after we heard from Najla Saeed. They are co-creators of the Theater and Audience Participation Project called Imperfect Allies, Children of Opposite Sides. They'll be presenting it tomorrow, Sunday, and next Wednesday, including conversations with audience members who want to participate. We'll tell you where shortly. And they join us now live. Judith, welcome back. And Najla, so nice of you to come, and welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, Brian.
I see that you conceived of the Imperfect Allies Project a few years ago, so before October 7th. Can you each talk a little about the original idea and goals for this project? Najla, want to start?
Sure. I originally met Judith because she hired me, and then she produced a sort of one-off performance of my solo show. And these are conversations that we've had between us for years, which we had decided we wanted to talk about publicly, because my show on its own talks about me as a Palestinian, but to have the other voice there makes a huge difference. And we had such interesting conversations, and our original connection was through our having lost our fathers so young. And so we thought it might be a wonderful way to try to bring other people into this difficult subject matter and help them talk and listen.
Mm-hmm. Judith, same question.
Yes. So that is true that we met not through Najla being Palestinian and me being Jewish, but because we had similar emotional kind of residual effects from our father's death, where we would react out of proportion to the present when we were losing things. So it was just as two women dealing with, oh, do you do that? Oh, yeah, I do that. Yeah, I cry out of proportion to the present. So then when we started working together, and I did hire Najla to read, to perform in Crossing the Boulevard years ago during the when Trump had just become president, and we were doing a lot of multi-ethnic, multilingual performances with many different actors of all different ethnicities. And so we've been talking for years. There was also a part of Imperfect Allies that was a discussion with Black and Jewish artists as well. So this seemed like the perfect time for us to do this. And after October 8th, and after October 7th and 8th, I teach at NYU, and I teach on Monday nights, and I have Palestinian students, and I have Jewish students, and people were coming to the class in, you know, all kinds of distress. And then Najla and I both had started talking in October. We did a performance that had been planned originally, and then we turned it into something else as a benefit for Doctors Without Borders and had a dialogue. And then we realized, oh, we should really try and figure out how to do these, because both of us had been in situations where we were in, I would say, I don't know how, what word to use, but kind of vitriolic discussions, and we wanted to do something different.
So we might talk about those excerpts that we played from each of your works, but would you set up for our listeners right away what the audience role is in the Imperfect Allies Project? Because that's such a big part of what makes these more than just going to a show, and we'll invite a few listeners in on this as well. So, Nesli, you want to introduce what the audience participation aspect is?
Sure. Well, what we did was we reached out to people who were interested, and we thought it would be a lot of Jewish people, a lot of Arabs, but we've gotten so many interesting people, some of whom come from regions of the world where there are similar conflicts. Some have no connection to it, but really would like to talk because they're scared and they want to ask questions. So what we're doing is we're going to start with the little performance, and then we're going to break into groups and encourage them to have conversations about what they fear, what they're confused about,
Hopes.
And hopes, that's yes. Always positive.
Section is.
But, yeah, so what's been amazing is the people who have sort of signed up are actually, even in their little one-sentence blurb about why they want to do it, saying such profound things that I was personally very surprised. I thought it would really just be a bunch of people who wanted to just come and talk, and that's always an issue with this subject matter, that people come and make long commentary and don't listen. But so far, it seems like everyone has got a questioning attitude and a desire to make some sort of positive outcome from this. So that, to me, has been the most interesting. But yes, we're going to break them into groups, and then we're going to make people listen and talk.
Make them. So. But, Brian, we're going to allow people to sort of share with the bigger group, but it's small groups. And Najla and I were both surprised. We didn't know what would happen, but we were surprised that so many people wanted to participate. And it's a hurdle, right? You have to answer a question to come. And at first we thought, well, maybe 10 people will come. But then when you get 90 responses, shows us something.
Yeah. So people, just to be clear to our listeners, people don't just buy tickets. They fill out a form to answer the following question. I think I have it written down accurately here. In a few words, what draws you to participate in this event? We're just curious and want to be prepared to make this a thoughtful and purposeful event, right? So that question, you can't buy a ticket without passing through that form?
Yeah. Some people just say things like, I have one here, it's all I think about lately.
Yeah.
So that's, but we do have some that we can share with you.
Yeah, you want to do that now?
Well, we're getting a lot of the cross sections of people and groups, because with this conflict, everything's become so binary, sort of ironically, given the world is trying to understand what non-binary is. But so the first one, I am a Jewish Moroccan Israeli New Yorker, and I believe there are so many secret narratives and points of connection that aren't being highlighted. I want to be in them.
And I think that's something that we're also realizing. A lot of Arab Jews or Jewish Arabs are also signing up. And so where does that fit in this dialogue? And then here's one. I'm Palestinian, grew up in Chicago, but lived in Palestine for 3 years, victim of Israeli violence, taught at a Jewish school for 3 years in Brooklyn, also rented from a Hasidic family here. Adored my landlady's grandson, little Moshe, who used to plant plants with me and always asked about my animals. I could tell they really liked me, but were also afraid of me, which is a strange experience.
Yeah. So, listeners, Najla and Judith want to invite some calls as kind of a mini version of what they're doing with their in-person audiences at their Imperfect Allies event. So if this sounds like the kind of thing you would want to participate in, what experiences or feelings of yours would you want to bring to share with people from the so-called other side? 212-433 WNYC, 212-433-9692. What hopes or fears or dreams or pain or love across the usual divide would you want to express in such a setting? Or what question might you want to ask an imperfect ally, a child of the other side, so to speak? Questions definitely welcome and encouraged. 212-433-WNYC, as they will model this right here on the show right now. 212-433-9692. And I probably don't have to say this, but what we don't want is people who just want to argue about which side is worse, which honestly is most of the phone calls we get, unless we ask a directed question like this. So let's try to avoid that in favor of what hopes or fears or dreams or pain or love across the usual divides in this respect would you want to express in a setting like Najla and Judith's Imperfect Allies events, or what question might you want to ask an imperfect ally, a child from the other side? Questions definitely welcome as well. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Najla, you have Imperfect Allies events tomorrow and Sunday and next Wednesday. I'll invite you to give the specifics at the end of the segment. But have you done any already with anything to describe about how the audience interacted?
We haven't actually done any of this specific event before, but I have done, when I travel with my solo show and my book, I often find that I have discussions that are really interesting, but there's a point at which there's a question of, there's a lot of Jewish identity issues and things that I don't feel are my forte. So, and also to make people feel more safe, it's better to have the two of us so that nobody feels like they're not represented. People are surprisingly, if you get the right people who want to listen, they are surprisingly humble and honest, and really a lot of the vitriol goes away because they have someone in their face that they maybe don't know that is looking at them with an open heart and an open ears. And it's a very different attitude to have than just arguing with someone on the street or, in a dinner party.
Yeah, or social media.
Yeah,
or
social media, oh my God.
Anti-social media for the the dialogues. But Brian, we have done these things separately. And so, yes, this is the first time we're doing it together. And some people, I think it's, there's so many different kinds of people in New York City. It is the world. And the likelihood of living across the street from somebody who, was an quote-unquote enemy in some other country is pretty high in the United States. And in New York City, years ago, I was invited into a high school to do some storytelling and community building between Tibetan and Chinese high school students, and talking about how the kids, the 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds, were not their government. And we also got somebody that answered the form and said that, she's from, when so much of our experience, I'm going to read it, when so much of our experience reduces us to violence, to reach across and create art that makes space for a different reality is a radical representation of our humanity. I also teach public humanities at NYU and Yale, and I am of Tibetan heritage. Invisibility and silence are unfortunate realities that are all too familiar. So that's been interesting for me and Najla also, that it is a lot of Jews and Palestinians that are coming, but it's also African Americans and Tibetans and people from other places that are wanting to be able to have this kind of dialogue.
Here's a question via text message. Listener writes, Najla, I love this. Right now, though, the urgency is with Palestinians because they are being killed so rapidly with such ferocity with U.S. funds. My question is how they are dealing with this exact moment. And I would imagine you would get a fair amount like that at your events.
Well, we're actually got some calls from some Palestinian members or, audience members that are coming who asked us if we would figure out a way to participate in, we're not going to go handcuff Netanyahu ourselves particularly, but but participate in helping getting Palestinian families of New Yorkers here. And I know that seems like a Band-Aid, but it is one way that we're trying to deal with it.
Yeah, and I think for me, you know, just to give a little more information about my play and my book, I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and have been mistaken for a Jewish person my entire life. And I don't push that away. That's part of my, you know, shtick, to be even more stereotypical with my language. But I think that those are the spaces, those liminal spaces where, you know, there's a cultural identity that comes with being a New Yorker. And to a lot of people, I seem like an Upper West Side Jewish person. And so these places where we live in the middle and, you know, we live in New York and we have to figure out how to live together. And I think, obviously, if you asked me to raise money for something right now, it would be to help people in Palestine 100% and to stop the killing. That's the major thing. But in terms of what I can do to make, you know, a small difference here in terms of, and this is something I learned from my father, is that it is important to tell stories and to carry this history with us and to not deny it and to not let people deny it. So for us, a lot of it is just saying it out loud is a huge, huge thing, even just being allowed to speak about our history.
I agree with that tweet. That whatever, did that come in a tweet or a text or something? This is the overwhelming issue right now, is that people are being not only killed but starved to death. And so we have to, you know, do whatever our part is in that right now. And so one of those things actually is responding to people that are saying, can you call your congressperson? Can you help get people out? Because we found out from people who've been calling us that a lot of the Palestinian families in New York are having to spend a tremendous amount of money for their families to bribe people to get out and get to each next step, which is very common in any fleeing situation, that people need money to bribe their way into the United States or wherever.
You're getting a lot of love in our text messages. People write, these are beautiful people. Thank you. Monthly segment, please. Another one, I'd love to simply watch this event. Would they consider streaming it? Many more could learn from it. Another one, we need more thoughtful across-the-table conversations like this. You give people hope. Thank you. Let's take a call.
And Brian, just quickly, I want to respond to that one text that.
Please.
We decided not to stream it on purpose because we did one little experiment with this and realized that people really want to not be public and want to have the space for small dialogues. And I've done this with my students, broken up into small groups of four and had small dialogues. So
yeah, we're also not allowing phones.
We're not
taking
allowing
away their phones.
And we're thinking this should be a book, you know, that's the space, not streaming.
Let's take a phone call. Namina in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Namina.
Hi, Brian. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm a little emotional after I spoke to the young lady. I want to thank the two ladies, and I want to know how they get to this point. For both of them, they lost their fathers. To come together to sit on a table and bring something like this. A lot of us are hurting. I came from Sierra Leone. The Blood Diamond happened and they killed my father. And there is no closure for me because he was in the army and there was no body. So the whole family, we cry every day for every little thing. So I'm saying I don't even have the courage to face the people who are in power at that time. Every time I see them, I get so angry. Mm-hmm. You know, so for me, these ladies, how do you do it? How did you find that strength? Because I don't have it right now, as you can hear from my voice. I have to go because I'm so emotional. And thank you for taking my call, Brian.
Thank you.
Who wants to talk to Namina?
I do, actually.
Model how you might, because you're going to get that emotion at your events, right?
Yes, and we have that emotion every day, and I invite you to come. There's links on the NYC website, and Brian knows this about me, that I was destroyed for many, many years. I was really broken up, just the way the caller was speaking, mm-hmm. and it was very hard for me to come to terms with my grandmother's suicide, because she killed herself when I was 9, and then my father died when I was 12, and then their entire family was killed somewhere in Vitebsk, but I don't really know where. And it took years of therapy, quite frankly, and having people around that understood that this was residual, horrible pain that has no closure, and there's no bodies, right? There's no way to find people. And so I think that that's part of what has inspired me to work with immigrant and refugee teenagers and to do all the work I've been doing for the last 30 years in New York. But it's really, really difficult, and you have to find people who are empathetic ears. And one thing that Najla and I were talking about personally in our friendship is that if you reveal a lot of pain and there's no resolution anywhere and there's no caring for it,
It
makes it worse. And so we have to find ways, I think, in New York to be able to embrace and hold all the avenues of pain, like we just heard on the phone.
Yes, and I would also add that the idea of, you know, talking about a country like Sierra Leone, where I'm sure in America a lot of people don't know what's going on there. It's very similar to having, up until recently, being Palestinian. I mean, there's a lot of people who have opinions, but not a lot of people who understand. And it affects us so personally. It's our identity. It's our story. It's our family. And so I think that the way in, even if someone is not from the same world, is to find someone who understands the complexity of being from a region that has issues like this. Because the way it's often portrayed here is there's good guys and bad guys, and it's much more complicated than that. So I would encourage you to come if you would like.
And to at least reach out to us in some way, because the other thing Najla just said, I think that's really important, is that it is very, things are very complex. And, you know, we interviewed people from Haiti who were living in a neighborhood where somebody else from Haiti, Toto Constant, who had terrorized Haitians, was showing up at their doors selling real estate. So that's a New York thing.
That's a very New York thing.
And you know, I remember when I was going through some grief, and I had said to my friend Frank, who was playing the trumpet on that Diana piece, I said, oh, what are the chances of a woman like me, whose whole family was, you know, my grandmother's family was killed in the Holocaust, and living across the street years later from a guy that we found out had been in the Hitler Youth, and who also fled to Queens, right, in the 50s probably. And I said to Frank, you know, what are the chances of that happening? And he said, 100%. Mm. And I think that that is where we are, Brian, in New York, that, you know, even at my NYU class, there are students from all over the world, from Zimbabwe, from Colombia, the country, not the university, and, you know, from California and from Iowa. And so these stories are, we're all sitting together in the same space.
Let's take another call. Amy in Ellenville. You're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi there. I'm usually on the Upper West Side, but at the moment I'm in Ellenville on my way back from the great solar event. And first of all, thank you for what you're doing as Imperfect Allies. And I'm a member of a national grassroots organization, Sisterhood of Salaam Shalom, and it's Muslim and Jewish women, and each chapter has to have a Jewish and a Muslim co-chair, and the idea is to get to know each other as friends, and then when hatred strikes, to be able to stand up together. And we have been very, very challenged since October 7th. And so my question for Imperfect Allies is, how have you been able to get the Imperfect Allies to speak to each other, to feel safe, not to feel hatred or anger? Thank you.
We'll have to let you know
after. And we hear Amy getting emotional about that, too.
We'll let you know after the third one, how it goes. I just wanted to clarify something, too, and I think, Amy, yeah, I understand. You said two things that struck me. One was that if you're friends before a crisis happens, you have a better chance of I don't know what the words are, withstanding it or continuing, because you have a deeper connection. I do think if Najla and I were not friends before this recent bombing of Gaza, that we would not be able to do this in the same way if we didn't have a deeper friendship. And I also wanted to just clarify that Najla is Christian, and so we're not doing Jewish Muslim on purpose. And you know, I think everything gets framed in ways that are not always accurate. So we have Christian Palestinians coming, Jewish Arabs coming, Jewish Israelis, Palestinian Israelis. You know, we have all these different kinds of people coming, and in the news it gets reduced, or it's Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. Well, we don't really quite understand that all the time.
I know you're aware you're doing this as an era-defining crisis rages on over there for both sides. So much bombing and starvation has come up, and the hostages are still being held. And hopefully this is a meaningful exercise in its own right at any time, but maybe even more so on this day of the Eid and just after Easter, and with Passover coming this month, and also April now being Arab American Heritage Month in the United States, as declared by President Biden in 2021. So this is year four of that.
So there's more awareness in general.
People, you know, might be even closer to this might be closer to the surface for people than it even is anyway with all of this going on right now, although everything is so close to the surface in the last 6 months.
Right, and I think with every time there's mass killing, you hear about numbers of people and the 32,000 Palestinians or the hostages that are still being held, that those individual people are not just numbers. And when the World Kitchen members got killed, there suddenly becomes new attention, but that's also not new. And you know, every war, it's when the Americans get killed or the Westerners get killed that people bring attention to it.
But I also wanted to just add one thing. We have we had a conversation where Judith was telling me something, and I maybe got a little bit worried that I might be offended or uncomfortable. And I said, I have to listen to you with my Jewish ears. And we sort of took that. A lot of, for me, is after October 7th, I've lived in New York my whole life, and most of my friends growing up were Jewish. So I got a lot of vitriol directed at me as the one Palestinian that people know after October 7th, and it was very hurtful. But I think also I know these people so well that I understand why they reacted the way that they did, and that's one of the hardest things to try to do. But just as an example, I finally watched Zone of Interest the other night, and I was reminded of how horrible the Holocaust was, and I mentioned this to Judith. And she's the one who said, yeah, but it's supposed to, it's also like in his Oscar speech, Jonathan Glazer made the very clear connection between Gaza now and that. And it was Judith who said that, and me who was sort of fixated on what happened in the Holocaust. So we have ways of seeing things through different eyes and different ears. We just have to be open to that, I think.
And in the performance that we're doing together, we often say things at the same time. You know, I need to listen to you with Palestinian ears, as that's coming out of my mouth. Or she's telling a story about her family. But I think that one other thing that's really clear, Brian, is that when I went to Israel for the first time, and I for the only time, actually, and I was performing there, but I was also trying to find some of my family in Yad Vashem. I also was invited to be with some Palestinian Israeli women that were Israeli Jewish women that were working together, and I came back and I wrote a story about a grandmother character looking like the sister of the, like the grandmother of the Palestinian family. And 25 years ago, I got a lot of pushback and vitriol from mostly Jewish audiences. I also think that for some of my Jewish students that are quick to say that everything is anti-Semitism, you know, criticizing the state of Israel or what's going on or the way Palestinians are treated. When you go there and you see that how people are treated as a Jew, it's brain crushing and soul wrenching to think that, okay, we were treated this way and then this is happening. And so I think that that can sometimes get interpreted as anti-Semitism, that it might be the first time people are like massively uncomfortable with what they had grown up with thinking.
So I'm sure even just that could start a whole other spate of phone calls, but it's also where we are out of time. And I want to thank Judah Sloan and Najla Saeed, who are co-creators of this new project called Imperfect Allies, Children of Opposite Sides. There are three events coming up in the city tomorrow and Sunday and next Wednesday. Judith, you want to tell people how they can sign up? I think the first two are sold out, right?
The easiest thing is to just go to earsay.org, earsay.org, and click on the links and get on the waiting list, because even if they're sold out, you know, five people won't show up because that's the way people are. Even though they answered a question, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be able to show up. So we encourage people to just go to earsay.org, and they can find more information as well.
Anything to add, Najla, as we run
out
of time?
No, but thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thank you for doing this. You're getting a lot of love from our audience for even trying. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Let's take some time to look at recently announced changes to the census. Last year, the Biden administration proposed an overhaul of the race and ethnicity section on federal forms to more accurately represent Americans. Amongst the changes is the removal of Middle Eastern and North African from the white box. Did you know it was in the white box? Creating now a separate MENA, or Middle Eastern and North African, category. Although we're not due to fill out another census for another 6 years, the updates have spurred questions about identity, how people choose to identify when their identity isn't officially recognized by the government, and how that affects the wider group's representation. As we know, Arab Americans will play a significant role in deciding the outcome of the presidential election this year. In Michigan specifically, we saw over 100,000 voters voice their disapproval of President Biden's handling of the war in Gaza when they voted uncommitted in that important swing state's primary. Given the election will likely be decided by a few thousand votes in various swing states, Michigan included, this group holds a lot of power in our country right now. Yet up until now, they've never been accurately identified in our country's census. So for Arab American Heritage Month, which President Biden declared April to be in 2021, so this is the fourth one, we will be dedicating a few segments to exploring the community's pressing issues in the United States, starting today with the question of identity on the census. Joining me now is Karen Zrake, reporter for the New York Times and board member of the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association. Her piece in the Times on the subject is titled, No Box to Check When the Census Doesn't Reflect You. Karen, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
So I gave a little summary of the change coming to the census, but can you tell us what exactly we'll see in 2030 when that next form lands in our mailbox and how this change came about?
Sure. Actually, at the end of March, the Biden administration announced that it was going to make some changes to the race and ethnicity checkboxes. The big change is that it is not asking for race and ethnicity separately. It's asking a combined question, what is your race and ethnicity? And that'll be followed by 7 boxes. And for the first time, MENA, Middle East, North African, will be among those boxes. So that is something that federal agencies have to start implementing now in advance of the 2030 census. You know, it should also be said that 2030 is a long time away. So this could change under a different presidential administration for the census. Mm.
And are there other forms that this will apply to between now and the next census?
Yeah, there's basically tons of official forms, and basically everybody, you know, in different states and companies and organizations around the country follows the federal government's guidelines for the most part on this. So there's lots of groups that are going to have to figure out how to change their forms.
And listeners, we invite your calls on this. If you're in the group, if you identify as Middle Eastern, North African, or Arab, if you would check the Middle Eastern, North African box on the census, if you had that opportunity, give us a call and tell us how you filled out federal forms like that in the past. How do you best represent who you are with the limited options provided on at least official federal forms? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Does it affect you in any way? Does it affect you emotionally? Does it affect you intellectually? Does it affect you practically? Does it affect you economically? Do you think it affects you in any concrete way that you weren't really reflected on the census and these other federal forms in the past? Call us if you identify as Middle Eastern or North African, if you would check that box on the next census. 212-433-WNYC, and tell us what this change means to you and if you like it. 212-433-9692 with Karen Drake, a reporter for the New York Times and board member of the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalist Association. And maybe we should get even a little bit more specific about the category, Karen, right? So MENA, mm-hmm. Middle Eastern or North African, who precisely does that include?
That is a great question. And that is a question that is not entirely resolved. It is not, you know, Middle East, North Africa, there's no overarching objective definition of, you know, where the exact boundaries lie for that category. So that's part of what is going to be adjudicated in the next few years, where exactly the boundaries are and who's getting counted in that category.
And it's so broad when you say Middle Eastern. So one thing that strikes me is if someone is a Israeli Jew who has mm-hmm. Middle Eastern roots or a Palestinian Muslim, they would check the same box. Think that's right?
Correct. Yes, yeah. Exactly. And Israeli is one of the examples on the federal government form.
Right. And here's a listener who's immediately texted to that point. Are Ashkenazic Jews white or Middle Eastern? How far back do you go? What about those of us that are distinctly pink? So that's a judgment call?
That are distinctly pink?
Pink, meaning, Ashkenazi Jews. I think the listener mm-hmm. is asking Ashkenazi Jews whose ancestors lived in Europe for a long time and they're mm-hmm. skinned by pink. They mean they look like a white person in the context of the United States, unlike mm-hmm. some of the Sabras, right? Or Middle Eastern,
right.
More Middle Eastern Jews in more recent generations. So,
right.
But yeah.
Yeah.
If an Ashkenazi Jew wants to say they go back to Middle East extraction, well, on one level, that's true.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these are all questions that are going to come up over the next few years. And again, like Israeli is on the form, you know, so that, you know, but is the person yeah. that you're talking about actually Israeli? I'm not sure. But also, I think it's important to point out that a lot, you know, I worked on a big story about this for the Times, and overwhelmingly what we heard from people who would check this box is that this is an ethnicity, not a race. akin to the Hispanic Latino category.
Right.
So it doesn't, you know, the question is not skin color per se.
Yeah. And things don't always line up so neatly when we try to draw categories around the fullness of human experience.
Absolutely.
So what if somebody is Moroccan, let's say, but their family, that is Moroccan American, but their family has been in the country for six generations, then they would be MENA, yes?
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that if your family was, you know, Cuban and has been here for many generations, you would be Hispanic.
Right.
Is my understanding. I mean, but, you know, you're picking the box that you want to be in, but that's the idea.
And I guess they say Middle Eastern rather than Arab because, for example, people from Iran are Middle Eastern, largely Muslim, but they're Persian. They're not Arab, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's many other minority ethnicities like Kurdish, Assyrian, et cetera, within Arab countries and in non-Arab countries as well.
Why were Middle Eastern and North African Americans counted as white in the first place? I mean, some of the countries we're talking about, especially in North Africa, they could really be black, but they were counted as white.
Yes. So basically, this has a very interesting history because in the early 1900s, the Arab immigrants who were in the U.S., who were mostly Levantine Christians, fought to be classified as white to circumvent rules that only allowed white immigrants to become citizens.
Uh-huh.
So there were a number of court cases, and basically a legal precedent was put in place that ended up lasting for decades and having these perhaps unintended consequences. The federal government issued guidelines in 1977 that defined people from the Middle East and North Africa as white, and then that never changed in the years after on the census until now.
Let's hear from a couple of callers. Marion in Hackettstown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I have to tell you, I almost cried when I heard that they were finally going to have a different designation because any form I've ever had to fill out, my family is from Iraq, and I would always pick other if that was an option and then write in Middle Eastern. And if there wasn't the box for other and I had to put white, it felt awful. I never felt white. You know, we speak a different language. We eat different foods. We have different names. I mean, Marion isn't even my real name. That's my Starbucks name. So it's just felt so false and so awkward and so uncomfortable. And it's just, I'm elated. It's I know it's psychological for me, but it's just not who I am.
Marion, thank you so much. We may hear a different story, a similar story, I should say, from Jacob in Brooklyn. Jacob, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, it's been on Brian. So, I mean, honestly, I do think it's like well overdue. But the thing is, I really, you know, have trust issues with the government because I would feel like they would use this, you know, data to like, you know, target Middle Eastern and people of North African descent. I don't know. I just feel like they would use it for, like, nefarious reasons and purposes. So, I mean, personally, I probably, you know, depending on the situation, might or might not, you know. I would, you know, me personally, I usually put, like, either Asian or sometimes white, depending on the situation.
Jacob, very interesting observation. And I wonder, I know you did a survey of people in the MENA category and asked them, you know, as kind of a test run for the census, what they would check. And here's a particular fear of Jacob, right? Given the perception of Arabs in this country, that he, as someone of Yemeni descent, doesn't want to check that box because he's afraid it might be used against them. Did you hear that very much?
Yes, we did. And it's something that, you know, advocacy groups who have been working on this for decades are also very aware of. And I think the counter argument is that it's important for people to be counted in official statistics, to be, for example, if we're trying to tabulate, you know, discrimination and hate crimes and stuff like that, there needs to be a category in order for those issues to be accurately tabulated.
Tell us more about that survey. I see that, again, You did a survey asking participants several questions about their racial and ethnic identity, creating a sort of test run for the changes to the census. What happened when Amina Box was included?
Yes. So I worked on a story where we had an admittedly unscientific poll on the Times website that was open for months, and we collected responses from a self-selecting group of people who decided to answer. And so what we found seemed to track with what social science researchers have found, which was that when there was no Amina Box, a lot of people who identify as part of a MENA community were checking another race. So it was basically making a lot of data vague and less useful, because it's very hard to discern anything if everybody's checking another race. So on our survey, we asked people, how they would identify without Amina Box and with Amina Box. And when we added the Amina Box, there was a drastic change. Nearly 90% of people who answered chose either just the Amina Box or MENA along with another category, like MENA and white, MENA and Hispanic, MENA and Black, etc.
And what's the result or the desired result of creating a MENA Box, a Middle Eastern North African box on the census? What significance does this update hold, or let's say, what practical implications for representation, for anything economic? What's the best case scenario, or what's the good faith hope of the people who are driving this?
Right. So there is some data on the ancestry of Americans from the ACS, the American Community Survey, which is done more frequently than the census. But that is only the census, which is done every 10 years, only that data dictates how people are classified across official statistical agencies. So for example, you need census data to look into the school achievement gap between different groups of students. And when we redraw political boundaries, there's often a lot of debate over whether congressional districts fairly represent various minority groups. But people of MENA descent, it's hard to, they're not officially part of the conversation because they don't officially exist in that data.
Listener writes, census data is also used by advertisers and marketers to determine, quote, size of prize in terms of consumer targets, which also relates to increased inclusion. You agree with that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that is true. I mean, it is, the biggest, most official, pool of data on people in this country. So that tracks.
Virginia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Virginia.
Yes. Hi. Hi, Brian. I've talked to you a few times before. I'm Armenian, and I always felt a little, I'd never know really. Caucasian was the only thing that allowed me to feel comfortable because Armenia and Turkey were in the Caucasus. So, but my parents were from Turkish Armenia. And I used to feel like it really didn't include me either. And I'm very happy to hear, because I always identify myself as Middle Eastern. Although I'm not North, I also appear white, so I am white, but I've never felt comfortable without the category Middle Eastern. Yeah. So it feels good.
So
feels
you think good. you're gonna check that one?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I guess Armenia, if you look at the map, look at the globe, it's kind of on the border of what the government intends for
actually, can
inclusion?
I actually was talking to some of the advocates about this point the other day, because there's actually some concern that Armenians are not going to be included or counted in the MENA category. I was talking to the Arab American Institute, actually, just a few days ago about this point, which is one of the big advocacy groups that has pushed for this in Washington. And that's been very involved in the conversations with the Census Bureau over the years. And the director of that group, Maya Berry, was telling me that even if the country of Armenia is in Europe, most Armenians in the U.S. come from a Middle Eastern country, the way your family did, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, et cetera, but still identify as Armenian as their identity. So, you know, a lot of some Armenian groups and, you know, other advocacy groups are pushing for Armenians to be included in the MENA category and officially counted that way.
Really interesting. And people will make their individual decisions since this is voluntary. And we heard from Virginia what she plans to do. Last question, Karen. Your piece included a quote that notes this change would be the first update to census racial categories since 1970, adding another layer of complexity to an already strenuous form. So is there warranted concern that the new racial category might confuse the average American filling out the census, might even dissuade completion of the census, and of course a full count is so vital to the public interest?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we've, you know, we're all grappling with the many questions that new categories and rejiggered categories raise. And some experts worry that more checkboxes and more write-in options might confuse people and make the form too complex to generate good data. So, you know, they did do a lot of testing about these questions. You know, a lot of testing over many years. But there's going to be, I would say that there's going to need to be a big public education campaign as well to explain to people, you know, what these changes are.
And we leave it there for today with Karen Zrake, reporter for The New York Times and board member of the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association. Her piece in The Times on the subject is called "No Box to Check When the Census Doesn't Reflect You." Now it will, more accurately for people of what they call Middle Eastern and North African descent. Thank you so much for joining us and explaining as much as you did.
Thank you.
Every memory you think you have of the past,
the house you grew up in, your first kiss,
it's not simply an idea, it's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Bridget Bergen, filling in for Brian today. Now we turn to higher education. The pandemic upended how kids think about higher education. The percentage of students who enrolled in college after graduating high school fell from 70% in 2016 to 62% in 2022, according to the Wall Street Journal. So where are all the kids going? Well, enrollment in vocational training programs is surging as overall enrollment in community colleges and four-year institutions has fallen. It rose 16% last year to its highest level since the National Student Clearinghouse began tracking such data. Students are increasingly interested in jobs like HVAC maintenance, vehicle maintenance, and construction to get them in high-paying jobs right out of school with very little student debt. Joining us now to discuss her latest reporting is Taping Chen, Wall Street Journal work and work culture reporter. Hi, Taping. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we're wondering if we have any young tradespeople, those currently in a trade program, tuning in now. We're calling all new electricians, HVAC, plumbers, or carpenters. Why did you choose trade school? Was it the rise in the cost of college, the job security post-graduation, or something else? And how's it going? Whether you're in trade school now or have recently graduated, give us a call. The number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. You can also text at that number. Tiping, I want to start with the kinds of vocational-focused trainings that are out there that are seeing this increased interest. Is it limited to just a few professions, or has participation gone up across the board?
Really, across the board, I was struck to see some of that enrollment data and the increases that you mentioned, just because I think it does run so counter to a lot of the perceptions I think people have of the skilled trade of it's shrinking, young folk aren't interested. I saw those numbers and I almost didn't believe them, so I started calling programs across the country and was just struck, whether it was in welding or HVAC, plumbing, etc., really hearing the same thing across states and cities, that yeah, we are seeing this jump, and it's real and it's pronounced.
That's so interesting. And Tiping, the shift in higher education is, of course, coming post-pandemic, where some young people saw their parents' so-called white-collar jobs up close, maybe too close. You spoke to a 20-year-old welder who always thought he'd go to college until he saw his parents work from home at their desk jobs, probably in front of a computer. What did he tell you?
Absolutely. So he was seeing his parents work from home, take their calls from home, effectively sitting in front of a screen 8, maybe more hours a day. And that didn't seem very appealing. And also, you have to remember, he was also part of millions of students across the country who were doing the exact same thing during the pandemic, right? For a lot of students, education looked like sitting in front of a screen for years. And so he walked away from that experience feeling like, I definitely don't want to spend my life working in front of a screen. And I also don't want to spend more time learning seated in front of a screen.
Not surprisingly, we're getting a good number of callers who have similar experiences to some of the folks you talked to. I want to start with Robin in Norwalk, Connecticut. Robin, thanks so much for calling.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm a mom of a person who did exactly what you're talking about. She didn't want to... He didn't want to be in front of a screen all the time. And so now he's looking into a trade. And he's actually kind of finding it a little bit difficult to find the trade that he wants to do. And I should mention, it's not cheap to do that. So it's not always easy to join a union if you don't have connections in the union, which is fair, not complaining. I'm just saying it's the fact. And now he's pursuing welding. He's going to see, do I like welding? But it's going to be like $3,000 to do the first welding class. Then it's going to be the next class is another $3,000. So it's expensive. Luckily, he can live with us. He's privileged in that regard. He can live with us. He has a job, but he lives with us while he figures out what he wants to do. But he's very excited. He wants to do the trade stuff.
Robin, thank you for that perspective. That was the parents' perspective. Let's go to Pat Nyack. Pat, thanks so much for calling WNYC.
Hey, yeah. So I am actually in a weird situation, or I love my situation, but I'm a Princeton graduate and a carpenter. I went to, Princeton, did my undergrad there, graduated, worked in the white collar world for a bit, hated it. Luckily, my father is from Ireland, so I grew up working a classic immigrant child life, as a carpenter's apprentice. And so, I continued to do it on the side after, while I was doing white-collar work, and then eventually lost my job and was like, you know what? I'm just going to do this full-time. So I was in the union for a little bit, and now I work for myself. And, just to the point of vocational school and whatnot, you can go to it. However, you can, that last caller just said it was expensive, but, an old-school apprenticeship is always not always free, but always paid. So yeah, it's great.
Pat, thanks so much for that call. Let's take one more. Raquel in Rockland County. Raquel, thanks for calling WNYC.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. Are you pursuing a trade?
Yes, I am. I'm actually a hairdresser pursuing cosmetology.
And why did you choose that route as opposed to something else after high school?
So actually, I was able to study cosmetology while I was in high school, and it was completely free. So I had absolutely zero debt, and that was the route that I could take to have no debt. I also knew that right after high school, I wanted to focus on my volunteer work. I'm one of Jehovah's Witnesses, and I wanted to be able to do more versus going to a four-year that would take more of my time away from my purpose and my family.
Raquel, thank you so much. And is part of what you're doing there, Raquel, sort of with an eye towards running your own business, you know, doing this on your own as opposed to, you know, working in someone else's salon?
So I am currently working in someone else's salon, but that also provides flexibility just with the type of job that I have. I can choose when I want to take my clients, but I also have the support of an employer and a team.
That's great. Raquel, thank you so much for calling and sharing that perspective. Tiping, before we get back to some of your reporting, any reactions to some of the callers that you heard there? We, you know, heard a parent with some concerns about the cost of some of this training, but then, you know, a couple of young people who seem really happy with the flexibility and the life it's providing them.
Yeah. I would say with the cost, that is something that can, you know, it does cost money, or it can cost money, certainly, to go to trade school. Some of the folk that I spoke to in reporting this piece were using their 529 programs that they had intended to use for standard four-year college to, you know, transfer that money to trade school. That was one mode of financing that some parents and families I spoke to took. Others were going to cheaper community colleges that have a vocational focus. There's also the route which one of our other callers outlined, which is that you can go the apprenticeship route. And in many of those cases, your employer will pay for your schooling and will also pay you a wage, and often a very good wage, while you're working and getting trained.
From the young people you spoke to, was there a sense that trade careers are more secure than white collar jobs? And were there clearer paths where you, you know, generally knew what the next steps were for advancement and how much you might be making in the future?
Absolutely. I would say that that was a really big part of the calculation for a number of the young workers I spoke to, the sense that these are jobs that are not going to be automated away and they're not going to be offshored. COVID was a period of incredible flux where people saw white collar jobs, you know, other sorts of jobs too, getting decimated, the sense of uncertainty, the world getting shaken up, which I think has only been augmented, especially as we think about the rise of Gen AI. And so, yes, the sense that these kinds of skilled trade work are not going to be disappearing anytime soon, and that there's a path that you can take. When I spoke with a number of workers, they could tell me really clearly often what they're going to make in 5 years because there are union scales that dictate it. And so they know, look, if I'm planning to buy a house by the time I'm 24, I know I can because I know my salary is going to be there if I stick to this.
And we also know the demand and pay for certain skilled labor is, you know, very high. You can, any homeowner who's had a leaky toilet or broken boiler can attest to that. What kind of earnings can newly minted trade workers expect to make right out of school? And how does it compare to those who, you know, perhaps went to a four-year college?
No, that's a great question. Well, median pay for new construction hires actually rose 5% to over $48,000 last year. And that actually outstrips what the same comparable, you know, median pay for new hires in professional services was last year. Last year, new hires in professional services were earning an annual $39,500. So you can see there's a gap there. Yeah, pretty striking. And over the last 5 years, when you speak to different trade groups and contractors around the country, the jump in pay has been substantial. I spoke to one executive director of an HVAC association here in Pennsylvania, where I'm based, who said that 5 years ago, if you were graduating from one of the trade schools that their association runs, you might have made $35,000 a year, whereas these days it's more like $60,000. So,
wow.
Yeah, no, striking. And when you look again, the contrast between white collar and blue collar might have seemed more striking years past and often less so these days.
Well, we have lots of listeners who have stories to share. Let's start with Adam in Flatbush. Adam, thanks so much for calling.
This is you. Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. I understand you went to trade school.
So let me just give you my experience and maybe my advice to anyone who's considering the same thing. So I went to a trade school program. You will pay a fraction of what you will for a four-year degree on average. That's true, but you will still pay. When you're done, in New York City at least, in the five boroughs, you're going to enter a market. If you don't have experience and you only have trade school or you have minimal experience, you're going to enter a market in the non-union sector that really is not going to pay you a lot for a very long time. On the order of like 4 to 5 years, you're going to be making maybe a little bit more than a fast food worker might. So if you're young and you're eager and you're bright-eyed and that's something you want to put the body capital and time into, I think it's a great idea because you're making money right away. But if you're not willing to stomach that kind of lifestyle and pay grade for that long, then a four-year degree is, in the long run, probably going to be more beneficial to you, even though it pains me to say that, and I wish more people would consider the trades.
Hmm. And so in the work that you're doing right now, do you feel like you made the right decision for yourself?
I had to walk away recently, so I would say my answer is pending. So.
Okay. Adam, thanks so much for calling and sharing that. Let's go to Dan in Darien. Dan, thanks for calling WNYC.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm a parent, actually. My son is in the first year of a two-year program to become a General Motors certified technician. And he goes to school 2 days a week at a program here in Connecticut under the Connecticut State University and College systems. And then the other 3 days a week, he works and learns and gets paid.
And how, as a parent, were you surprised when he decided to pursue a trade, or was that something that you were expecting from him?
Yeah, not at all. Good question. I actually introduced him to a local vocational school in Stamford that's fabulous, the Wright School, back when he was in middle school, thinking I could see that he was had no interest in really book learning, and I could see that desk jobs, and especially now with AI, et cetera, are kind of under threat. So he bravely chose to go this way because in our town, everybody goes off to college, which is basically like 4 more years of high school. But here he is entering, quote unquote, the real world. And you have to be very brave to do that, and I'm proud of him.
Dan, thanks so much for your call. Tiping, any reaction to those callers? We have a full board of people who want to share their stories, but I want to give you a moment since you did so much reporting and spoke to people along the way. How do those experiences and the stories we've heard so far match some of what you saw when you were reporting the story?
Yeah, I do think some of the challenges, of course, associated with life in the skilled trades are very real. It's super hard. It's a grind, right? So one of the workers we featured in my story, she wakes up at 4:30 to get to the construction site on time. I also spoke to recruiters who said, look, we have a lot of folk who have jumped in and there's more workers coming online. And so it can be hard to get jobs sometimes too, especially if you're a new, more inexperienced worker. As new construction has slowed in commercial, for example, there's a feeling of, okay, sometimes I can't get a job because employers want somebody with more experience. So there absolutely are those challenges and the concern longer down the line, what am I going to do when I'm older, right? This is a physically taxing trade. I will say a lot of the young workers I spoke to were interested in sometimes walking away from college paths because they saw the sense of, I can be an entrepreneur, I can hang up my own shingle, build this up. By the time I'm older, I'm going to have established myself and, you know, have my own business. And so I think there's a sense of many kind of paths that you can go in the skilled trades, but obviously plenty of challenges too in the mix, just as there would be with any other industry.
Let's go to Rebecca in Queens. Rebecca, thanks for calling WNYC.
Hi. I was calling because I actually did a vocational program in high school. I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and that's where I learned how to weld. My sister did an auto body course, but then I ended up going to art school at NYU, and I didn't learn any practical skills there. And all of the best jobs I've ever gotten are because I know how to weld.
And are you still doing welding now?
I'm actually wrapping up a welding project as we speak, putting away some tools. But yeah, sometimes I wonder, you know, if I had just done the straight vocational program or continued it after high school if I would be making more money than I am now, because the arts really don't pay very well and there's no like union jobs in the arts.
Rebecca, thanks so much for that call. And Tiping, she raises something that I think listeners who are intrigued by this conversation are probably curious about. You know, in your reporting, you cite a survey of high school and college age people by a software company, Jobber, last year. It showed that 75% of respondents said they would be interested in vocational schools offering paid on-the-job training. So for people who aren't familiar, what kinds of educational options are available to students who are interested in the trades?
It's really a spectrum. You can start at the high school level. Certainly there are programs in high schools around the country. They have been obviously, I think, greatly weakened in recent generations as we have as a nation pursued more of this college for all model. But in my reporting, I spoke to a number of high schools that were intent on restarting that, you know, traditional sort of shop class, bringing in more resources, allowing you to earn credentials even at that earlier high school level. And that's something that is important for, you know, to allow people to get a foothold into the trades. And it's also something that when you speak to high school counselors will say has had an effect also on how people perceive the trades, right? And helping to combat some of the stigma traditionally that has been associated with a path in the skilled trades. There was a sense for years in many high schools that kids who went the vocational education route were the grease monkeys, right? And they weren't able to hack it in an academic course. And increasingly, there's a sense that that isn't necessarily the case. Well, as you point out, there's survey data showing that students are interested in vocational programs offering paid on-the-job training. We know that parents often, the same survey found 80% of them want them to pursue a college education. So there is that sense of stigma, and that's an obstacle often that you see more in the older generations. With regard to the different paths they can pursue, so yes, absolutely, high school is one avenue that you can pursue more so than previously in a number of communities. And as well, you know, we're talking community colleges, we're talking private trade schools, we're talking get hired at a company that wants to train you up. There's such a demand for labor that you do find a lot of employers will take you, no experience needed, we'll get you there.
Let's go to some more of our callers. Kevin in Denver, Colorado. Kevin, thanks for calling WNYC.
Hey, very welcome. The only thing, I'm basically retired, though if the right opportunity comes along, I'll definitely take it. But I started out in broadcasting, worked, you know, at NBC, migrated into production work, working on commercials and some really minor films many years ago, and then kind of like saw an opportunity and migrated into computer technology and worked as a coder, and then moved into like corporate middle management, and then through other kind of layoffs and things like that, I ended up in construction back in the video world. So it's I don't know, keep your eyes open, keep your head up, and, you know, maybe just like go with the flow and you'll get to do a lot of different stuff.
Kevin, thanks so much for that call and for your optimistic view on life and approach to it. If you're just joining us, I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Brian Lehr. I'm speaking with Tiping Chen, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers work and work culture. And we're talking about Gen Z young adults who are going into the trades instead of going into college. We're coming to the end of this segment, but I have a couple more questions for you, Tiping, and really a completely full board of callers. So if you're waiting, thank you so much for calling in. One question that I have to ask you is, how much of a factor do you think the rising cost of college has had on many young people's decision to go to vocational school? And how do the two forms of education typically compare when it comes to time and money? We've heard some callers talking about how these trades still require cost and training, but it seems to be significantly less than the investment of some four-year institutions.
Yeah. So I do think the rising cost of college has had a substantial effect here in, I think, almost every conversation I had with a young worker entering the skilled trades. That was something very much on their minds. But even beyond that, I would say too, it's a combination of high cost and also this question of utility, right? There was a new study out recently by Burning Glass Institute and Strata Education Foundation, which found that around half of college graduates end up in jobs where bachelor's degrees aren't needed. And so I think there is a skepticism increasingly of the sense that, well, I might end up spending a lot of money on a degree that I'm not even going to need. And also we've seen too, a job market in the past couple of years that has been often quite challenging for white collar job seekers, fresh grads. And so I think, yes, all of that conspiring to make the trades seem more attractive, because at the end of the day, yes, it will cost money often, but substantially less, right? As one of our callers pointed out, the students that I spoke to pursuing this path were paying anywhere from maybe $3,000 to $20,000 for their programs. So, you know, that absolutely is an investment, but less of one typically than you would see for a 4-year. And we're also talking about a quicker path, right? Anywhere from the student that we're talking about earlier who pursued a 9-month welding program to someone, another student I spoke to was going into a 2-year, you know, that we're talking about a shorter time frame than a 4-year college. And as one of our other callers was talking about, you know, we can also, we often do have the ability to pursue this education while simultaneously working and getting paid.
I want to bring in one more caller, another proponent of the trades. Let's go to Tony in Egg Harbor, Wisconsin. Tony, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your view on going into the trades?
Well, obviously, it worked out for me. This is 50 years ago in 1974. I graduated high school. I was never an academic, and my dad told me, don't go to college. You're wasting your time and my money. Go learn a trade. And I enrolled in a 9-month HVAC program. I've owned my own company for 43 years. I just sold it in Chicago. And in 1974, the trades were really a, you know, for those kids that couldn't make it in college. And I don't know if it's really evolved past that, but I think it's the best opportunity. And I think our trade in particular is egregiously short in having women.
Interesting. Tony, thank you so much for that call. Congratulations on your 50 years in that trade and the success it has brought you. It sounds like there's a lot changing in the trades, and we're going to leave it there for today. My guest has been Tiping Chen, Wall Street Journal work and work culture reporter. Tiping, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.